Okay, I'm gonna call this meeting, the House Finance Committee, to order. The time is currently 1:34 PM on Monday, March 1st, 2021. And present today, we've got Representative Thompson, Representative Lavon, Representative Edgman, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Merrick, Representative Rasmussen, Representative Josephson, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. And just a reminder, if folks could mute their cell phones. So at today's meeting, we'll have two presentations. We'll hear first from the Office of Management and Budget with an overview of the COVID-19 funding. And then we'll hear from the Department of Administration on the pandemic preparedness plan. And so with that, we've got Neil Steininger, Director of Office of Management and Budget, as well as Paloma Harbor, Fiscal Management Practices Analyst for OMB. And if you could both please come to the table and put yourselves on record.
Okay. Good afternoon. For the record, Neil Steininger, Director, Office of Management and Budget.
Good afternoon. For the record, Paloma Harbor, Fiscal Management Analyst with the Office of Management and Budget.
Thanks for being here.
So to start, I'd like to go over a little bit of a timeline on the state's fiscal response to COVID, as well as some slides on the timeline of the federal fiscal response to COVID. So the state has had three different bills, four different bills on three separate events related to COVID relief. So initially on March 16th, the legislature passed and the governor signed the mental health budget, HB 206, last session. In that budget, there was an estimated $9 million in federal receipts, as well as $4.1 million in unrestricted general fund. At that time, we sought that the response to COVID would be, maybe quarantining a couple of travelers coming into the state, or other sort of smaller activities, lower cost things. We're looking at maybe renting some hotel rooms out to put people up, and some smaller measures for the cruise ship traffic that we expected to come in during the summer. By April 6th, we had gotten a little bit of a better understanding of, those initial cost estimates were, very, very low compared to what things were starting to look like. At that point, we had, some federal receipts that we put into the supplemental budget related to housing relief from housing and urban development at the federal level. We had $8.5 million that we put forward specifically for coastal communities, still anticipating a cruise ship season. We appropriated money that would allow them to take measures to mitigate the spread as a result of both cruise ship traffic as well as workers that we had anticipated coming into that state at that point. And we also had $15 million added to the Department of Health and Social Services emergency programs budget related to other, at that time, what we thought would be the need for pandemic outreach and activities that emergency programs and epidemiology would need to undertake. In the operating and capital budget, passed slightly later than the supplemental budget, an additional $75 million of, this time from the CBR, but of unrestricted general fund appropriations were included for health and social services emergency programs. We also capitalized the disaster relief fund with $5 million from the CBR and, an estimate of $9 million at that point of what we thought we would be getting from FEMA. Come April 9th, by then we had a much better idea of what was going on. Things were changing day by day, week by week. That's when we actually had the disaster declaration bill, SB 241, implemented. From the financing side, from OMB's budget finance perspective, the key things in there were authority to draw from the disaster relief fund now for $10 million of use from the disaster relief fund, as well as a handful of references to funding that were in those prior bills, including predominantly what we ended up using being that $9 million in HB 206 in estimated federal funding, which, because it was appropriated as an estimate, allowed us to expand that funding to include a lot of money that came into Department of Health and Social Services for response and mitigation. So during this time period, things were rapidly changing. You know, if we all remember a year ago, between March 16th and April 6th, the world really changed. One thing to note on these dates is these are the dates of when those bills were signed. So when the legislature passed the supplemental and operating budgets, there's very different information about what federal funding would be available than was available when the governor signed those bills. So it was a moving picture this entire time. And if I can go to the next slide before we go to questions, because that illustrates a little bit of what was happening at the federal level during this time period as well.
And just for the record, we've got Representative Wool here as well. And if folks want to, we'll do questions as we're going through here. Folks have questions, so.
So on the federal side, March 6th, again, early in the pandemic, you know, the federal government similarly was looking at this as a much smaller cost, smaller activity event. The first federal relief package, the Coronavirus Preparedness and Response Supplemental Appropriations Act, was $8.3 billion on March 6th. And that really covered things like vaccines, smaller grants, and humanitarian assistance. Come March 18th, the family's first Coronavirus Relief Act, which had $105 billion, so escalating up a little bit, added things like paid family leave for those who caught COVID, you know, allowing for, you know, expansion of the ability to be granted leave from your job. Also, this is where the increase in the federal participation for the Medicaid program came from. So that increased our collections by 6.2% of federal match for the Medicaid program. Come March 27th, you know, this is one that everybody talks about. This is the CARES Act. Often CARES Act is used to refer to kind of all of these bills that are on this slide, but really it was a distinct passage of an appropriations bill from the federal government on March 27th, and that was $2.3 trillion. So you really see, you know, even at the federal level, that evolution and understanding of what we were facing between March 18th and March 27th with a very rapidly moving time period. This is where the bulk of the programs that we talk about come from, the Paycheck Protection Program, Pandemic Unemployment Assistance, as well as the Coronavirus Relief Funds, or the CRF. This is the $1.25 billion that was granted to the state of Alaska with, you know, fairly loose guidance on how to spend it, and that's where primarily most of the funding for state responses come from. Subsequent to that, a couple of those provisions were extended in the Paycheck Protection Program and Healthcare Enhancement Act, which expanded some of those programs that needed to be kind of re-upped in their funding. Then December 27th, the most recent act, and this one we're still, you know, working through understanding all the money coming into the state and how to utilize it, is what's commonly called CARISA or CERSA, depending upon who's trying to pronounce the acronym. But it's the Coronavirus Response and Relief Supplemental Appropriations Act. This has a lot of money coming to areas like Department of Transportation, a lot of open-ended funding there. There's very similar provisions to other areas in CARE or areas in CARES Act. A lot of those programs were expanded through this. Money going out to school districts was expanded considerably here, as well as money for the university. It also changed some of the terms of the coronavirus relief funds and extended the deadline to spend that money through another calendar year. Pause here if there's any questions on kind of the timing and when things were occurring.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, Mr. Steininger, the March 27th bill, which is the real CARES bill, the $1.25 billion, that was the RPL portion of the 5.2, is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the RPLs covered, you know, a lot of different pieces in there, but the bulk of the discussion around the community assistance payments as well as the Alaska CARES Small Business Program came from that 1.25.
And the remainder, which is almost four, tell us about that. That was the PPP and other related programs, or
Yes, through the chair, Representative Josephson, and we have one of the attachments that you have, and we have some slides that go into some detail on it. If we can cover it now, or we can wait until the slide's up. Okay.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Steiniger, going to the December 27th, 2020, for lack of a better term, bullet, I guess, the $683.8 million that went to Alaska under CERSA, you said a lot of that money went to the Department of Transportation. Is that correct?
Through the Chair, Representative Ortiz, yes, there's the larger amounts of kind of what have less strings attached, I guess, of the money, the more discretionary funds came from FTA and FHWA, the Federal Transit Authority and Federal Highway Administration, came into Department of Transportation. There also, another large chunk of the money there came in for education-related purposes. So that would be another $130 or so million that went out to school districts, and another large amount that came in for university.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, again, I guess similar to Representative, are we going to hear more about that particular breakdown of the where that money went and how it was spent, or whether there's still some to be spent later on in the process?
Through the Chair, Representative Ortiz, yes, we have some slides on that and attachments.
Thank you. Go ahead.
So a breakdown of all the money coming to Alaska. So there is a spreadsheet that backs this up. It's the sheet with the blue header titled Federal Funding to Alaska for COVID-19 Response. The spreadsheet attempts to lay out the different grants based on the act which they came to us through. So based on that timeline from the prior slide, you know, since there's so many different federal acts out there and different programs coming in, it can get kind of complicated how you sort and organize how much money has come in. So when you look at the spreadsheet, it breaks it down sort of in a kind of timeline way when we received the money. Kind of the big picture, though, public sector, you know, the state government, you know, received $1.25 billion in unrestricted money, but then there were other monies that came through the state of Alaska that then went out to public and private individuals, or public and private organizations, as well as individuals. When we try to break down where the money ended up, you see about $1.5 billion going to public-private kind of other entities. Individuals within the state received about $1.3 billion. This really is in the form of the unemployment assistance, as well as some paycheck protection money, or paycheck protection is through the businesses. Impact payments, the tax rebates that individuals received during the summer. Paycheck protection shows up in the $1.7 billion to businesses, and about $500 million went to tribal organizations throughout the state. But the individual grants themselves are listed out on this sheet. And one thing to note about the numbers on this sheet, which total out to about $6.3 billion, is that this is based on what we know now. Things like the Paycheck Protection Program or UI benefits, it will take some time before we fully understand how much of that money has come into the state, because there's a lag in the reporting between when that grant happens and when the individual receives it, because they don't actually run through the state budget. So this number, the 6.3 number, will grow over time as we see some of those programs impact Alaskan businesses and individuals.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The $6.3 billion, that's basically all the other, from the previous slide, that's all of them added up and then distributed where they went within the state of Alaska.
Correct.
That's all.
Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in terms of oversight of all this,
where does it end up in terms of you know, being in the executive branch? Is it the Department of Commerce, or is it your shop, OMB, or is it, you know, conjunction with the two of you working together? Because as I look at that pie chart up there, a lot of that money, I believe, has been dispersed, but not all of it. And so there's a certain amount of tracking that needs to occur. And it'd be interesting to hear your thoughts on who's tracking all that. And given the fact that Alaska is, what, one of a handful of states that's going to be audited in terms of how this was expended. And correct me on that if I'm misstating that as well. But would like to hear your response to those questions.
Through the chair, Representative Edgeman, the actual administration of these funds really varies based on the grant. Some of them are administered by Department of Commerce, as you said, the small business grants, the Alaska Cares program, as well as grants out to municipalities are managed by Department of Commerce. Department of Health and Social Services manages a very large portion of the $1.25 billion, the amount that we had reserved for specifically for the, you know, health and mitigation and, you know, impact mitigation portion. That's managed through Health and Social Services. Department of Education manages a very large amount of these funds in terms of what goes out to school districts. Department of Transportation manages a large amount of the funds. All of the different pots of money and different grants listed on this sheet have distinct criteria for in terms of record keeping and reporting. One thing that we did very early on in the pandemic, kind of before even any of this was really known, was start to establish coding in the state's accounting system so that we could track dollars spent from any source on COVID, and that we could, you know, kind of knowing some lessons learned from individuals who still work for the state who worked in these areas during ARRA, you know, kind of the last large federal relief effort. Just knowing upfront tracking of expenditures, you know, keeping things pretty fastidious about how you code things in the accounting system is important, because, like you said, you know, we've been selected for a desk review of our reporting, and so we kind of knew that might happen. So we need to make sure that we're tracking, make sure that we have processes established for reporting. Ms. Harbor, in our office, she is here because she's the one really at OMB who coordinates with all of these agencies on a day-to-day basis to ensure that, you know, we are meeting the guidelines set in those federal regulations. A lot of the $6.3 billion, though, doesn't flow through the state. We don't necessarily have responsibility for how it's spent, because it's going straight from the federal government to the recipient. So we're not... Our, you know, exposure and reporting is not the entire $6.3 billion. It's, you know, a lesser sum of that that comes through the state. But it certainly is a, you know, it is a good question. How are we tracking? And each grant really has its own individual criteria. We also produce reports that we provide to the legislature on these expenditures, and have now started to post to the OMB website as well.
Madam Chair, so as a sort of the repository, the place to go to ultimately to get the information you're providing to us, it's OMB. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Edgeman, yes, we're trying to aggregate it all into one place so that, you know, those can be informed. And I'll let Paloma answer as well.
Through the chair, again, for the record, Paloma Harbor. Absolutely, we're trying. But as the director mentioned, the money that doesn't go through the state agencies is a little harder to track or ensure that we have captured, but we are trying to capture everything we can. As an example, there was some money that went directly from the Federal Transit Administration to the Municipality of Anchorage for transportation that I did not capture in the 6.3 that I still need to add. So it's a change. These numbers change as often as I find out about them.
I may just one final follow-up, because I guess that we're going to get more opportunities to talk about that. There's plenty to talk about, and certainly in anticipation of the next tranche of money that comes into Alaska. maybe some lessons learned along the way as well to capitalize on. But I'm trying to get a better sense of who to turn to in terms of getting information. I mean, even the basic question of how much of this is maybe encumbered but unexpended. You had mentioned, Mr. Steininger, the fact that the deadline for the end of calendar year 2020 had been extended for, was it $528 million or $560 million of the original $1.2 billion of CARES Act money? For a lot of the communities who didn't get around to spending their money, for example, a lot did, but many didn't. And I only ask this sort of by way of prefacing the larger discussion that's going to come our way as a finance committee, because we have to build the budget for the upcoming year, but as well try to factor in a lot of these one-time payments that may have some relationship to the budget we're building. And it does, not to belabor the point right now, but it does certainly bear a larger and a more in-depth discussion at some point in terms of where all this is, you know, what's happening out there and who's coordinating it and what information do we have. And I'll close by just saying that I can see this with this next tranche of money coming forth, however much it is, and whenever it arrives, the legislature hopefully playing some sort of a role in terms of overseeing what happened, where it went, and again, to say it one last time, its relationship on the budget and, you know, things that we're tasked to do.
Mr. Chair.
I think Representative Josephson's up and then Representative Wohl.
Thank you. Through the chairs, Mr. Steininger. Going back to a question I had this morning, one thing that would still be very useful to me is if there were a document, and maybe there is, maybe it's sitting in front of me, that would reflect the administration's opinion of monies that backfill. I was frustrated by the June 28, 2019 vetoes and the April 7th vetoes. To the extent that those vetoes have been ameliorated in some way by CARES Act funding, and to the extent that FY22 cuts, and I'm happy to see there aren't enormous cuts, but that those are also satisfied by this revenue, that might change my disposition or position. Because clearly $6 billion is just an enormous sum. And but it's very hard. You know, it's hard enough to do a budget when you don't have COVID. But this adds another wrinkle in terms of trying to understand, right, this piece, for example, public radio, simple, discrete example. It had, whatever it had, $3 million, and then it had $1 million. That was important to rural Alaska. Is there something that came in that covered that issue? If it did, that might change my view of the world. And I don't know if there's anything that's sort of that handy that exists from OMB.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, we do have reports that lay out how we distributed the $1.25 billion, which is in your packet and has some summaries on a later slide, where you can see where, you know, kind of those allocations were made. It doesn't necessarily cleanly say, does this backfill some other cost? But some of them do. So one saying that is eligibility criteria or a presumption of eligibility for CRF dollars is expenditures on public safety personnel, so both Department of Public Safety as well as Department of Corrections. So we did utilize some CARES Act money to backfill costs in those agencies to avoid supplemental needs in this current fiscal year and to allow us to lapse money in the prior fiscal year, in fiscal year 20. So there have been some actions here that are backfilling costs where we do have eligibility to COVID or to the CRF. There is, of course, one stipulation within that eligibility is that it can't be a, you know, prior budgeted cost, with some exceptions like corrections and public safety. So there's some difficulty in backfilling with the CRF dollars. However, when you look in our 22 budget, we have other areas that we backfilled as well. particularly in Department of Transportation, because they don't have that, those monies don't have that same restriction on being a prior budgeted cost or backfilling of lost revenues or those different strings that kind of tie our hands on the CRF dollars. And then also in Department of Health and Social Services with Medicaid, utilizing some of that money that was displaced by additional federal funds to kind of cover future costs. Not quite as direct as, say, what we're doing in Department of Transportation, but a similar idea. In terms of comparing, you know, what was vetoed to what is there now through some of these distributions, some of those comparisons can be made. You know, when those vetoes were made, as I mentioned earlier about education, you know, we had a certain amount of knowledge. You know, we knew money was coming in. We saw it might have less restrictions than it did or more. And so we made veto decisions based on that limited information. When the money came in, we were able to utilize it for the most part the way we thought we could, but not perfectly. It's not a perfect one-to-one, or maybe it was covering one cost, which allowed, you know, a community or a school district or whatever beneficiary to free up funds within their own operating general funds to cover costs that we maybe would have supported through a vetoed program. So it isn't, there's not necessarily a perfect tie or a one-to-one, but you know, $6.3 billion coming into the state in one form or another has certainly offset some of the problems, but not all of the problems as a result of COVID.
Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The checks that came from the federal government to individuals, there was one for $600, there's one for $1,200, depending on how many kids and so on. Where is that in this, that's listed on that first page three, that's part of this $6.2 billion?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, on the slide that's up, it'll be in the orange section in the bottom right for individuals in that $1.3
billion.
Yep. Follow up.
Thank you. So that's $1.3 billion. In individual checks, okay, and out of the 6.3, so $5 billion is non-individual checks, and yeah, I'm just trying to, because 6.3 is strangely twice the PFD amount of 3.1, roughly, of the statutory PFD would be $3 billion if it was fully funded. So basically we got twice that in federal money, of which 1.3 went to individual checks, and then $5 billion was spread out amongst other agencies and businesses, private and public, it looks like. I guess, no question, sorry, I'm just thinking about
that. Any further questions? Mr. Steininger?
Oh, sorry.
Representative Wool?
Sorry, thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have a question. So basically we're getting to the state of Alaska, $6.3 billion, the equivalent of about $6,000 per person. Is that large compared to other states?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, large in terms of population, maybe. I don't know. I don't know other states' kind of per capita amounts. What I do know and what I can speak to, there is an analysis done that was released, I believe, last Monday, that looked at the impact of COVID to various states' economies and then that impact when offset by federal relief coming in. Far and away, the state of Alaska was the most impacted, even net of federal relief. When they then factored in access to reserve balances, we came down, I think it was fifth or sixth on the list, because some of the other states that also were greatly impacted don't have necessarily the reserve balances that we do. But when that agency was looking at reserves, they're including the entire corpus of the permanent fund. So they're not really looking at the reserves the way that we do. So what I can say is I would look at that net of federal benefits pre-reserves when comparing us to other states, and we were far and away more impacted than any other state in the nation.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you. Thanks for bringing that up. Is that, I think I just saw that today, Alaska's negative 42.5% in revenue. Is that the one you're talking about? Or that had to do with tax revenue, my understanding. Some states weren't affected because the stimulus money helped their local economies, which helped sales tax and so on and so forth. So a lot of economies that thought were going to take a big hit didn't. Alaska did take a big hit because mostly oil tax was affected and other revenues with not having a sales tax. I don't know if that's the same one you're talking about. But
Through the chair, Representative Wool, if it was a Moody's analysis, yes. So Alaska in particular, because our state revenue is so reliant on oil and our community revenues are so reliant on tourism, and both of those industries being the heaviest hit in this event, really puts us at a disadvantage on a national scale when you look at the impact to the state from this pandemic.
Follow up?
Last point, thank you, Mr. Chair, for indulging me. But the fact that $6,000 per capita came in, or $6 billion, is quite a stimulus to the economy. And many other states realized a stimulus and in their revenue portfolio due to the fact that they did have things like a statewide sales tax. So the states that had that were able to have a much better post-COVID recovery than we may have realized some help from the $6.2 billion. It just doesn't show up in the state revenue side.
Through the chair, Representative Wool, I think I understand now what you're getting at. Yes, it's our position and our structure in the state. You know, this amount of money coming in, while it's a huge amount of money, does not fully offset the impacts to our state. In other states where, from a state revenue perspective, they may not have had revenues as so uniquely tailored towards those industries that were impacted by this pandemic, the federal net of federal relief, quite a few states are, from the state perspective, financially better off. State of Alaska very much so is not.
And just for the record, want to note Representative Johnson joined us much earlier. Next, we've got Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for clarification, Mr. Senator, is the economic impact payments on the federal funding to Alaska for COVID-19 response chart that you guys have provided for us, the spreadsheet, I guess, towards the bottom of the second page? It lists just under $600 million, I believe. Is that considered the $1,200 stimulus payment that people received?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, that is a $1,200 stimulus payment, but I don't believe that includes additional stimulus payments because we don't have that data yet. So I believe it's just the payments made this summer.
Yes.
Follow up?
So do we have information on the number of families in Alaska or individuals who received that assistance?
Ms. Harbor.
Again, for the record, Paloma Harbor, through the chair, Representative Rasmussen. I don't have the number of individuals that received it, just the amount that came to the state, or to individuals in the state.
Follow-up statement. I think if we're thinking about stimulating the economy in terms of, financial impacts, that I believe that a large percentage of Alaskans did not receive the stimulus, I think, based on our average household income, from what I've heard. I know that we have a lot of people that work in the oil industry, and they were impacted financially or laid off as a response of the pandemic, and the prior year their income did exceed the guidelines set by the federal government. But I think as far as stimulating the economy, if we put money out into the economy and that money goes to families who are using the funds to stay alive and not actually spend any discretionary money, it probably doesn't have the same impact as something like a dividend where there are people who are able to use it as discretionary income and some people use it as a lifeline. So just thinking about the overall economic picture, I want to make sure that we kind of keep that point of reference, because there's obviously more than one factor when it comes to economic impact from the pandemic.
Okay, any further questions? Mr. Steininger?
So slide five kind of draws this in into a little more focus in terms of just the federal funding that passed through state agencies. So when we talk about what we actually have, you know, visibility into and responsibility for, this is what that picture is showing. So you can see the largest amount is the CRF dollars, COVID relief funds. Next to that would be the unemployment compensation that runs through the Department of Labor. We also have nutrition and emergency relief grants that run through the Department of Education, which are a little over $250 million. And then the airport and transit stimulus through the Department of Transportation is quite large. Recently, the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation received $164 million through the CERSA Act for housing relief and rental assistance programs. So that's another large chunk that we have responsibility for the management of distribution. The next are, you know, a handful of much smaller items comparatively, but still, you know, large dollars and impactful programs that come through the federal government and go out through departments.
And again, thank you. Just to comment on those smaller slices, those do not include the CERSA funding yet. So the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention funding has not been increased by how much will come to the state for CERSA vaccinations and other things that we expect to get. So those numbers will grow.
So, and now I'm going to hand it off to Ms. Harber to talk a little bit about the more in detail on the COVID coronavirus relief fund and a little more of the history and timing of what's happened over the last year.
Again, for the record, Paloma Harber. So the coronavirus relief funds were a part of the CARES Act, as we discussed, which was signed at the end of March, or enacted at the end of the March. And the CARES Act had three broad parameters for the expenditures of the funding. They had to be necessary expenditures incurred due to the public health emergency. They had to be not accounted for in the budget most recently approved for the recipient. And they had to be incurred in the period from March 1st, 2020 to December 30th, 2020. The Coronavirus Response and Relief Supplemental Appropriations Act, or CERSA, or CRSA, whatever it is, extended that expenditure deadline to 12/31/2021. When the funding was initially announced or enacted, there was a lack of guidance or direction to the recipients of how the funding could be spent, except for those three broad parameters. Treasury released their original guidance and frequently asked question document on April 22nd. And the frequently asked question document had exactly four questions and answers, and they were basically those three broad categories restated. So the state, as it was developing its revised programs that came to the legislature for review and approval, had very limited information on how the funding could be spent on the restrictions beyond these three basic categories. And we developed the programs that we could based on what we knew. And those were, as mentioned, the community relief grants, the small business relief grants, and we'll go into more details on those. As you can see, there were considerable iterations of that guidance from Treasury that significantly changed our understanding of the programs. The National Governors Association, the National Association of State Budget Officers, the National Association of State Auditors, Comptrollers, and Treasurers, the National Conference of State Legislators, all these groups were regularly coordinating questions to Treasury to try and get better guidance to states and local governments. so that they would know how to best use this funding, because there was a lot of concern, especially that we would spend it thinking that we were spending it correctly and then end up having to repay it. So we did our best in developing some revised programs to help meet the needs of the state as we knew would fit within the parameters of this funding. As I mentioned, the guidance kept changing. We had to submit our first report, official report, to the to the federal government on September 21st, and it had to include all expenditures from March 1st to June 30th. And the guidance for that report did not come out until July 31st. We had already received 5 months of reports from communities on their spending, and we had to make them redo those reports based on that guidance from Treasury. And they went from 6 categories to 18 categories that they had to report expenditures in. So we worked with the Alaska Municipal League and the Department of Commerce to get those revised reports from communities, and they turned it around very quickly. They did an amazing job of getting us what we needed so that we could meet that federal deadline. I did highlight in purple September 2nd, because that was the last major revision to both the guidance document and the frequently asked questions from Treasury, which are now federally registered.
Sorry. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, on page 6, the CERSA money, or the CERSA extension, does that, relative to Representative Edgman's question, if you're a community of a Yupik village of 400 and you received $100,000, broadly speaking, you now have through the end of this year to spend that? Is that, that's what that says?
That's correct.
Can't follow? I'm curious, given Ms. Harbor's testimony, how the state, you must have had to hire additional people just to manage in all of these agencies, to manage the, the monitoring of all these funds. How did that happen? Or did you just set your regular work aside and?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the Department of Commerce tried to establish a position to help with their CARES Act funding, specifically the Small Business Relief Program, so that they could ensure adequate reporting. They had no success in filling that until they could fill it. They handled it with existing community, what do they call them, government, local government staff. Thank you. And so basically all of the agencies, Health and Social Services, Department of Commerce, even OMB, have had to absorb this work with existing staff. We were able to bring in a temporary staff member in OMB to help with the reporting, the federal reporting, which has been great. Anything else?
And I'll just add a little bit of clarification to that. One piece of the report that we send to the legislature includes personal services costs. A lot of those costs are time that, a otherwise budgeted person, is spending now on COVID. So one of the frequently asked questions addresses, this idea of not accounted for in the budget most recently approved, that point two, and what that means for staff that, was budgeted, existed, had an existing job, but is now spending their primary work duties on COVID. And so we have a lot of staff in the state that, otherwise had a job and now are, kind of just working on COVID. A lot of staff at Department of Health and Social Services, really attention diverted to COVID. Department of Education, work they would have done otherwise, they're now working to help districts, respond to this. And, even within OMB, having to realign staff to that. So that's really primarily with a couple of non-perm positions, one at OMB and, looking at like contact tracers and bringing that kind of staff on, but trying to make do with what we have, and it's the focus of the year, effectively.
Representative Edgman.
So
And I might have missed this. You were talking earlier this morning, I think, about a desk review. But when I think of a desk review, I think it's something like a management review. You differentiate it between an audit and a desk review. But if you might maybe talk a little bit about what's expected with a desk review, and if there's any sense that the state could be on the hook, as there was initially, learning about what all the strings that were attached to the $1.25 billion back in April, which of course changed repeatedly, as you pointed out. But what's the prospect after this desk review is completed that the state could be on the hook for money that's been mismanaged or misspent?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, so I could not say at this point whether or not there will be any questioned costs. The desk review will primarily be looking at what we reported and the supporting documentation of what we reported, and was it adequate? Did we have adequate internal controls? So it's very low level. If they find something of concern, then it could develop into a full-fledged audit. If it developed into a full-fledged audit, that would be the point at which potentially questioned costs could be identified. If questioned costs are identified, the state has an opportunity to identify other eligible costs to substitute for the questioned costs. And so if a local community received the funding and they had questioned costs, we would work with that local community to identify other costs that were eligible to try and substitute. But that's a whole process, and hopefully we won't have to go through that.
Mr. Chairman,
hello?
Sort of the premise for my question is just to project forward that if worst case scenario did develop, do you have the infrastructure at the agency level or even at OMB level to follow this through all the way, assuming eventually an audit were to take place and we were to find some level of malfeasance?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, in terms of infrastructure to respond to audit requirements, we're assuming again respond to any audit requirements that come forward from the OIG. Speaking of question costs, if question costs are discovered, if say either a community or the state have spent money that do not meet the guidelines, or maybe spent it prior to an updated frequently asked question that changed the nature of what was eligible, the ability to substitute other eligible costs gives us sort of a level of insurance that we won't have to pay money back to the federal government necessarily. We know one of our sheets here illustrates the amount of CRF dollars that have been allocated and the amount that's unallocated as of this point. We know that there are costs far in excess of that amount that's been allocated that are eligible costs, places where state staff have diverted their work to COVID, places where we've spent money, but it's been within the bounds of the operating cost of that agency that we could apply any question costs to. We're not concerned that there will be, a payback necessarily. We think that there is, that ability to work through those question costs, the ability to work with the federal partners, if that's identified, is sufficient to give us that insurance that we'll be able to respond to that if need be.
And
I'll ask a question, Mr.
Representative Benjamin.
And so just looking at a few slides forward, the amount that went out to the community of the $1.25 billion CARES Act money was some $568 million. But would it be that portion that if the worst case scenario were to happen and you were to find that money wasn't spent as it was supposed to be, would that just be that chunk by and large of the $1.25 billion, i.e. of the entire $6.3 billion, or would there be other categories that you would be prone to focusing on?
Ms.
Harbor?
Through the chair, Representative Edmund, it could be any of the categories. I do think the community spending is the most potential, I should say, I guess. I don't want to even say that, but.
Or even if I may, just most traceable.
Most what?
Traceable.
Yeah, And my biggest concern with the community funding, so as the director mentioned, the other funding, like through health and social services or other states that went out to cover other costs, we as a state have substitutable costs that we know. The ones that went out to the communities, that community has to have incurred substitutable costs, or they could have incurred expenses against this that are then questioned, and if they don't have the substitutable costs, then they're in a situation. Does that make sense? So that's the area of greatest concern.
And I'll add a little bit of to that response. When we entered into those agreements with the communities, because we were handing control of the expenditure over to the community, part of that agreement was that the community was taking on that responsibility to spend the money per CRF guidelines. So in every agreement with the community, it was laid out, here are the guidelines, you know, here's the process. And you know, as we were entering into those agreements, it was midway through this timeline that you can see. So part of that was these guidelines from the federal government, from OIG, from the Treasury, you know, are prone to change. You know, it's your responsibility to make sure you are managing to the guidelines as they change. So should a community not have a substitutable cost and have a cost that's not truly CRF eligible, not able to substitute it, the agreements we have with those communities are that they are responsible for that return funding to the federal government. However, we also have the opportunity, you know, if it goes through that process that far, to find substitutable costs within state payments, because the overall grant, we are the prime recipient of the grant. So that $1.25 billion, you know, needs to be spent on allowable costs, you know, anywhere underneath that umbrella, of which the community distribution is part.
And I would just state real quick, again, the extended deadline does assist us. The fact that we're having our review early and that we have until December 31st to spend the money, if a community can incur, maybe their current expenditures aren't allowable, but they can make a plan that is allowable before December 31, 2021, they can expend the funding until then on eligible costs. So that's a benefit.
Ms. Harbert, Ms. Harbert?
Okay. So this is just a little bit more information on the coronavirus relief fund allocations. As we talked about, 45% of the funding, or $568.6 million, was distributed in the form of community relief grants. $290 million was distributed for small business relief. $50 million was allocated for nonprofit support through the Alaska Community Foundation, and $10 million was distributed as housing support through the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. $331.4 million was provided to the Department of Health and Social Services to cover other COVID-related costs. Of the money that was given to the Department of Health and Social Services, $133 million has gone out in the form of non-state agency support costs and services, and $153.4 million has gone out for state agency costs, which include things like COVID leave, personnel services, associate. I have a whole slide on that, so we can talk about that later. And then $45 million has not yet been distributed, but is in reserve for other COVID costs we know we're going to have. And that's all I have on this slide.
And also alongside this slide is a spreadsheet with the green header that gives the breakdown, particularly of this $331.4 million of other COVID reliefs that ran through Department of Health and Social Services.
And this does show the amount expended, because I know that's a question that came up earlier.
I don't see any questions.
So getting into some specific areas of non-CRF related costs, we have a couple of slides, and we have subject matter experts online for each of these sort of focus areas, if you will, if there's questions on them. So the unemployment insurance payments, as we all know, have, there's been a spike in unemployment claims over the last year. So benefit payments from March 1st through February 4th, just regular unemployment insurance from the state UI Trust Fund totaled $323 million. Federal pandemic unemployment compensation was $530 million. Pandemic unemployment assistance, which is 100% paid by the federal government, was a little over $68 million. Emergency unemployment compensation, again, another one that's paid 100% through the federal government, was $57 million. There's also lost wage assistance from FEMA, and that also, again, fully paid by the federal government, just shy of $59 million. As of February 24th, the UI Trust Fund had a balance of $286.1 million. While this balance is not on the high range of their target, it's within the range that they consider to be healthy, but it is at the lower end of that range.
Questions? Representative Josephson?
Through the chair, Mr. Spenninger, I mentioned the bill in Washington a couple times. I think it's the second bullet, the pandemic unemployment, which is the, anyway, I think that's being considered for extension and perhaps retroactively. Is that, do you have any knowledge of that? Retroactively to November or sometime when it expired?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, we can get back to you for sure or maybe on the phone, but I believe the CRISA extended all of these programs. Now, maybe not retroactively, and that might be the difference. Under the new relief, it might be applying these retroactively. But we'll confirm that for you.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the regular UI draw, if I'm assessing that correctly, is $323 million. The fund balance right now is $286 million. Does that mean another year of normal draw, there wouldn't be enough, or does it get refilled constantly from paychecks that are going out, and as I understand, there's less paychecks going out right now. So how does the UI Trust Fund look going forward, I guess, for the next year, anticipating still whatever our unemployment rate is now? I know it's gone down, but how does that look?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, we do, again, have a subject matter expert on the phone. But again, as the director mentioned, this is in the healthy range of the UI Trust Fund balance. So
it is
a healthy balance, and there will be revenue coming into the fund over the course of the next year, obviously, from paychecks. And we did ask on the trend of spending looking forward, and the department said that they actually expect regular UI payments to go down because eligibility, you know, you can only be unemployed for so long and be getting regular UI payments. The pandemic emergency unemployment compensation, that's to extend that eligibility, and that is 100% federally funded. So the reliance on the state funds will actually go down as federal funds reliance goes up. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Hold up. Thank you. So after its regular UI of $323 million, everything under there is completely federally funded, even though that one line, it's called federal, but you didn't write 100% federal.
That's correct.
So yes. Everything there below the 323 is federal. There's 286 right now. It will be replenished on a, how often, how frequently does it get replenished? With monthly, biweekly?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, payments are made quarterly.
Quarterly.
But if you wanted to ask further questions, again, we can defer to somebody online.
Sorry, I couldn't hear that.
If we need to, we can call on somebody on the phone.
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, any further questions? Seeing none.
So this slide covers relief that's come through to higher education institutions in the state. The CARES Act included $7.9 million to the University of Alaska, as well as $71,000 to the Alaska Vocational Technical Center. In that act, it mandated that 50% of those funds go directly to students in the form of just direct relief to those students. The other half of those funds could be used by the institutions for eligible costs. So students received $3.9 million through University of Alaska and $35,700 through AVTEC. Additionally, other minority-serving institutions received money, of which UA received a portion and received $2.6 million. In CRISA, there was an extension of these amounts, but you can see that that extension, a larger portion of that went to the institutions. So the institutions have been greatly impacted in terms of revenues from enrollment, as well as student housing and other areas that sort of had to change the way they do business due to COVID and eliminate some of those congregate settings. So the University of Alaska received $17.4 million from CRISA, of which, again, $3.9 million went to students. So rather than the 50-50, it was just a flat amount to students. Similarly, AVTEC received over $250,000, of which, again, $35,700 went to students. You'll note AVTEC, in the state supplemental budget, we've included a supplemental appropriation of $750,000 for AVTEC, even with this relief coming in from these higher education items, as well as other cost-saving measures they've been implementing. The loss in revenue to AVTEC has been pretty significant, and just the ability to continue to operate the facility, even after the federal relief, they require additional funds. But unfortunately, because CRF has restrictions on revenue replacement, we're not able to really tap any other COVID relief efforts from the federal government to satisfy that need. And so that's why, while you see these amounts coming in for AVTEC, it's that supplemental request is not duplicative of these amounts.
Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The first University of Alaska, $7.9 million, the students got half of it, $3.9. My understanding of that was because the semester got disrupted, a lot of kids had to go home, so on and so forth. What was the justification for the second 3.9 to the students? Because that was later on. From my understanding, a lot of people returned to school. Enrollment at certain campuses was even up. I just didn't know what the federal justification was. Explanation, I guess.
Through the chair, Representative Wool, that was a federal requirement of the monies. I don't actually know their justification for it. I'm not sure if we do or don't have a representative from the university. No, we'll ask them if they have an understanding of that and get back to you.
Great, thank you.
Please proceed.
So this slide is representing the K-12 side of education relief that came in through these acts. There are two different sort of funds that we talk about related to education relief. One is the Elementary Secondary School Emergency Relief, or ESSER. $38.4 million came into the state through the CARES Act for this that was distributed out to school districts. There was also $3.8 million that was allocated for the state education agency, that's the Department of Education. Local education agencies that is synonymous with school districts in our state. This had a cap on the amount that can be used for administrative expenses. So there was rules around this money related to how it can be granted out and what it can be used for that are different than the rules surrounding some of the other programs. This in particular has restrictions on use for administrative expenses and restrictions on the types of grants the department can issue. There's also the Governor's Emergency Education Relief is $6.5 million from the CARES Act. This is an amount of money that is a little more open-ended in terms of its application to specific education-related items more at the discretion of the state than the ESSER money. So looking at that, we utilize some of this money as grants to school districts, $3.7 million. Part of that was to help fill that gap between, you know, as we discussed this morning, between what was vetoed in education funding and the amount available to different districts. There's also money granted to the University of Alaska, because at the time of CARES Act, that amount on the prior page was not as much as the institution was being impacted by COVID. So we knew they needed additional resources above and beyond what CARES Act had granted them. And we also did some competitive grant awards to education-related entities, as well as a grant to the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program. The next slide goes into kind of similar programs for CERSA. This just covers what's in the CARES Act. So on the CERSA side in December, and the same programs had additional funding allocated to them. And the ESSER program had an additional $159.7 million. And I think I have misquoted that twice today, saying $130 million. It's really approximately $160 million. I apologize for that. Of which 143.7 is directed specifically to districts. Another $15 million goes to Department of Education, which can be used for education-related grants, again, with a cap on administrative expenses. The Governor's Emergency Education Relief Fund received another $2.8 million, and then emergency assistance to non-public schools were allocated $2.4 million, again, with caps on administrative expenses.
Question from Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. Steininger. So, CERSA is the December 27th Act, very recent.
Yes.
And the local education agencies, our 53 school districts, got $143 million?
Yes.
Very nice. And follow up? What what can they spend it on?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I'm not sure the exact restrictions on the school district expenditures on this money. We do have somebody on the phone from the Department of Education, though, if you'd like to bring them on to answer that question.
Okay. And with Ed, is that Lacey Sanders?
Yes.
Lacey, are you there? If you could put yourself on the record.
Yes. Hello. This is Lacey Sanders, Admin Services Director for the Department of Education and Early Development. Can you hear me?
We can hear you great.
All right. So, yes, the CERSA funds all CARES Act and CERSA funding was to address the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic. That said, the recent CERSA money included an expanded list of available activities, and that was to address learning loss and summer programming, such as summer schools, and school facility repairs to reduce the risk of virus transmission and improving air quality. So CARES Act and CERSA were to assist schools with the impact from COVID-19, but CERSA is expanded specifically for learning loss.
Representative Josephson?
Yeah, I think this is, Mr. Chair, I think this is coming back to me now, having had some Zooms with school boards and school related professionals. It's very helpful. Thank you.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Saunders, is there a specific breakdown as to what was received by the individual districts throughout the state? How much was received by each district as a part of that total package?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, yes. So on our website and in materials that we'll be providing the committee, we have a breakdown for both the CARES Act by school district and the CERSA. And I just want to expand on my previous question, or the previous question as well. The allowances in this funding are very broad, and so it does give those school districts the ability to spend the money within the federal guidance, but it is fairly broad on how they can determine to use that.
Thank you.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So earlier conversation today, school districts came up, and State of Alaska was deficient 2,000 students, but then I said my own school district is lost 2,000 students, probably to not charter schools, but homeschooling outside of the district. So this 2,000 student enrollment loss translates to about $20 million. This money can be used for that, I'm assuming, and have they not gotten it yet? Is that why they're a little bit panicked?
Through the chair, let me speak to the timing first. So as Director Steininger mentioned earlier, the original CARES Act passed back in March, and we have been working with school districts to get their applications and budgets as early as FY 2020. So when the school districts determined that they wanted to use that money, they were able to, and they have been. We have been working with them most recently on their FY 2021 applications. They do have an extended time period that this funding is available for. It's available through September 30th, 2022. The timing for CERSA, that money was recently passed, more in December, and we just now were able to get the application for that funding available on, I believe, February 15th was the date that went live. So we're now working with school districts to get those that would like to use or access that money available and approved, and they also, that funding has an extended time period through September 30th, 2023. So I think there's a lot of planning that school districts are needing to do as they look at what their current budget is based on the formula for state aid, and then what state funds, or excuse me, federal funds are being allocated to them, and then how they're going to determine those are used over the next several years.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I don't see any further questions.
So moving to slide 12 goes over some of the relief that's been received by the Department of Transportation. In the CARES Act, the department received relief from the Federal Aviation Administration and the Federal Transit Administration. In CERSA, they received relief from Federal Transit and Federal Highways. So a little bit of a difference between those two acts, primarily in the CARES Act, with the $82 million coming from Federal Aviation, was focused on maintenance and operations of state airports. So the state of Alaska manages a large number of rural airports that we're responsible for. $49.4 million came in from FAA to cover costs of operating and managing those airports. Another $33 million went to the international airport system, the Fairbanks and Anchorage International Airports, for operations maintenance of those systems. This is fairly open-ended funding as long as it is related to the operation and maintenance of those airports, but it does offset a lot of general fund spending, and you'll see in our fiscal year 22 budget use of the Federal Aviation Administration funding to offset general fund spend in maintenance and operations for the Department of Transportation in fiscal year 22. The FTA money is a little bit narrower in scope towards transit-related activities. So that includes the Alaska Marine Highway System. Money from this grant also went to the railroads and municipal transit throughout the state. In CERSA, the transit portion was increased to $55.8 million, so additional money going out to communities with transit authorities, as well as available for the state's transit, both railroad or marine highway system. Also, the Federal Highways Administration added $124.4 million, which we've just in, at the end of last week, received the guidance document from Federal Highways on how this money can be utilized. And so we're still understanding the utilization of this money, but we've utilized it so far to reopen some maintenance stations on our highways to cover, you know, snow clearing and activities like that. We have a portion that has not yet been allocated to a specific purpose. Our budget amendments included a capital project identifying the amount of money available here, but not specifying exactly where it should be spent, as we hadn't yet received that guidance document.
Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the piece for the Alaska International Airport System, and I'm having a deja vu moment here remembering this. That $33 million, I recall that approximately 27 or 28 million of that went to the Anchorage Airport, and about 5 million went to the Fairbanks Airport. Is that roughly correct?
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, I'm not sure on the specific numbers, but the way that this FAA allocation came forward was effectively a list of every airport in the country and a dollar value associated with it. The funding itself went to whoever owned and managed those airports and could be sort of redistributed within the airports that they own. Yeah. So, for example, the rural airport system that Department of Transportation manages, 100-some-odd airports, they don't have to spend exact, you know, to the dollar what that distribution was on each airport. So similarly, AIA, the Alaska International Airport System, can distribute that money between the two airports differently than it was lined out in that list.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. I guess where I was headed with this is not so much the split between Fairbanks and Anchorage, but I recall that Merrill Field received about $18 million in funding, and was that funding from the rural airport system allocation of $49 million?
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, I don't believe so. Merrill Field was outside of. DOT is on the line as well, if they can clarify that specifically. But I believe Merrill Field was outside of that 49.4.
I'm just curious, one last follow-up. Under what formula or what level of thinking that Merrill Field receives $18 million and Fairbanks International only $5 million? And you don't have to answer that, but that's my comment.
Mr. Dom Pannon with Transportation, are you there?
Yes, Chairman Foster. Good afternoon. For the record, Dom Pannon, Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. So for the CARES Act allocation formula, there were a number of variables that the FAA looked at, which included debt service as well as operating expenses and revenues. So for Merrill Field specifically, their number came out where it did because of the formula the FAA used. And Director Steininger is correct. The state does not own, operate, or manage that airport.
Representative LeBon.
But am I correct that they received an allocation of about $18 million for some purpose related to the CARES Act?
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, that number seems in the ballpark from, if memory serves me.
I guess my hope and dream would be that the Fairbanks International Airport would be allocated under the same formula as Merrill Field. Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Chair, Mr. Steininger, the sums on page 12, were these direct grants for which the Office of the Governor could appropriate or not so much appropriate, but allocate? Or are these, did we do RPLs on any of these at all?
Through the Chair, Representative Josephson, the CARES Act items, we did RPLs in order to allow Department of Transportation access to those funds. For CERSA Act, we did RPLs for reopening of some of those maintenance stations. The rest is subject to legislative appropriation.
Follow.
And because we're in session, the last item, the $122 million, that's firmly in the hands of the legislature to appropriate until such time as we adjourn. Is that right? In other words, the Office of the Governor didn't spend that yet, and so it's in our hands to speak to first.
Through the Chair, Representative Josephson, roughly speaking, yes. We didn't have this information as to what these grants would be when we developed our budget and released in December. Since we've included budget amendments that would cover the continued operation of those maintenance stations that we included in the RPL package, but we haven't put forward a specific proposal on the additional FHWA funding. Part of that is because that the guidance document around exactly how it can and cannot be spent wasn't available at that time. You know, we believe the maintenance station support would be allowable, but we weren't sure what the other boundaries on the funding was, and so we didn't make a specific recommendation in our budget amendments. Simply, we identified the amount that's out there and available. So it is up for legislative appropriation, and as we understand that guidance document, we will likely come forward with more of a recommendation based on the guidance that we've received from FHWA.
Follow up?
I mean, it strikes me that if, not because we don't want it to revert to your authority, but certainly these funds, there must be a deadline on spending them. So they should make their way into a capital budget before May, or we're sort of negligent, strikes me. We need to find a way to utilize these pursuant to the guidance and find something meaningful to spend it on. Is that right?
Through the Chair, Representative Josephson, yes. And knowing the amount of money, having that during the legislative process gives us the information to have an appropriation for these dollars rather than needing to utilize the LBNA process. The LBNA process was heavily utilized last year simply because we didn't have the information about the money coming in before the legislature adjourned. We don't have that disadvantage now.
Okay, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So through the chair, I was wondering on the grants for airports. Did the airports that are municipal airports like Kenai and Palmer, did they get money through the state, or were they able to go directly and get some money for the airport? Do you know right off?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, thank you for the question, because also lets me kind of put a finer point on things with the airport allocations. The formula was done by the FAA and was outside of the state's control. So things like allocations to Merrill Field versus Fairbanks International weren't a decision of the state or the Office of Management and Budget. It was the FAA's formula. But yes, the other municipalities that own and operate their own airports, you know, here in Juneau, the airport is run by the city, they received allocations through this formula as well. And that list is available online if you know, we can direct you to that list and provide that in our responses to questions.
Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since we seem to be stuck at airports, My recollection from meetings last year, Merrill Field notwithstanding, but Anchorage and Fairbanks in particular, that the calculation was somewhat based on loss of revenue due to loss of airline traffic, loss of people buying, you know, going through the airport, maybe businesses not renting from the airport anymore, and also loss of cargo traffic, which is a big part of Anchorage's commerce. But did that pan out? And maybe this is a question for the DOT individual on the phone. Did Anchorage experience a loss of cargo traffic, or maybe the opposite during the pandemic? Was there an increase in cargo, seeing as a lot of people are ordering stuff? I don't know. But if there's an increase, maybe they didn't have the loss of revenue that they anticipated.
Through the chair, Representative Wool, I think I will give that question to the representative from Department of Transportation because he might have better specifics on it.
Mr. Panon?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, I can say that the CARES funds that were allocated from the FAA to the international airport were used largely to keep operations at status quo. They were used for debt service payments. Our deputy commissioner has a great presentation on an increase in cargo traffic and a decrease in passenger traffic, and the airport relies heavily on revenues derived from passengers. So I would offer to present that information at another time.
Okay, thank you. Okay, and I see no further questions.
And we'll provide those statistics with our responses to questions as well.
Okay, again, for the record, Paloma Harbor, Office of Management and Budget. As mentioned previously, 45% of our coronavirus relief funds went to community relief grants so local governments could meet the unique needs in their communities for residents and businesses. The information on this slide is as of February 26th. The January 31st expenditure reports from communities were not due until this week, and so they are not the latest and greatest information. Within a week, we should have even more information from communities. But as of February 26th, there were 26 communities that had not entered into a grant agreement with the state. A number of communities, when coronavirus relief funds were first made available, did chose not to enter into an agreement because of the tight timeline to spend and, again, concerns about eligibility of expenditures. A number of those communities have indicated that they're willing to enter an agreement now that the expenditure deadline has been extended, so we're working through that process with them. We expect that number will continue to shrink. But that represents about $2.3 million that has not yet been granted. There's another 37 in total, which includes the 37 additional. We already have grant agreements with, but they have payments pending. So we split the payments into three tranches, and they have to spend up to 80% of the previous tranche before we'll give them their next tranche, just to make sure that they are actually spending the funding. And so those 37 communities have additional payments pending. 50 communities have fully expended their funding as of December 30th. So they were on track to spend it, and they fully spent it. This is a little bit more information on the community spending. Again, this was as of what we had collected in reports on February 26th. But this week, we'll get a number of new reports, and these numbers will be updated. $504.6 million in total has been spent, 35% on payroll for public health and safety, 22% for small business assistance, 15% for other economic support, 8% for housing support, 7% for public health expenses, 6% for medical expenses, 2% for other payroll, and then much smaller percentages for the other categories, facilitating distance learning, administrative, improving telework capabilities, food programs, testing and contact tracing, and nursing home assistants.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious. I know one of the controversial issues in Anchorage was the local government's decision to spend about a third of the money that the Muni received from the state on homeless housing, and I believe that was about $60 million. I'm just curious where that's reflected in this chart.
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, I do not believe those expenditures were incurred as originally intended. But if they were, it would be in housing support.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On another note, I was looking back at the slide on page 7 that broke down the small business relief and the community grants. And I guess I was curious, does the state feel that the small business relief program is functional, that it could serve the entire state rather than bypassing the money to the various communities? Is that something that, is there a handle on it? Could that, should more money come to the state, is the state equipped to handle distributing that rather than putting the small business relief out to individual communities?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, there's kind of under the CARES Act distribution, there are kind of multiple ways that relief was given to small businesses. There's both a state program ran by Department of Commerce through ADA, the Alaska CARES program, as they called it. And then there were also smaller programs within communities. So the small business assistance of $109 million here is in addition to that $290 million that went to Alaska CARES. So there was a bit of a mix between the two. We really feel, and the way that we distributed this money when we were making those decisions in the spring last year, was trying to put as much money down as close to where it would be spent as possible. So sending it to those smaller political subdivisions, to those communities where they could allocate based on their individual community needs, but then balancing that with some of the statewide approach through things like Alaska CARES. And I think that balance has been good. There's some the question about 2020 hindsight of, what can we do differently with our next distribution. I do think that balance of, some money being allocated with a statewide perspective through Department of Commerce, looking at the overall picture, but then also allowing communities individually to say, maybe that's not as much small business relief as we'd like, or maybe that's not as much individual personal relief as we'd like, and making that allocation independently. So I think that relationship has been pretty successful in terms of having some ability to allocate at a lower level. So with additional funding coming into the state, whatever form that ends up taking, it's hard to speculate since it's still at the federal level being, debated at that level. The way that gets allocated, depending upon how much discretion we get from the federal government and what other resources are there for small businesses, I think retaining some of that ability for those at the level that know the impacts that have happened in their communities to have control, as well as some statewide perspective, will be something we want to retain.
I appreciate the comments. I guess my thought is the more the state can streamline the entire process and get the relief quickly out to small businesses, the better, in my opinion, and I hope that my colleagues all share that view. We know that Southeast Alaska is going to be impacted in a major way, it looks like, by the tourism industry and the decisions that have been made with the cruises. So I guess my question is more geared towards, is the state at a place where we can handle distributing more money directly to small businesses and bypassing communities? Because I think it eliminates confusion on both the small business owners who are trying to navigate and you know, process the applications that they need to follow, and just have it all housed in one place. So I think it benefits the public, and it's more transparent as policymakers for us to see how the money's moving around, I think.
Please proceed.
So this, and again, Paloma Harbor for the record, this slide provides you additional information on the state's COVID-related expenditures. As the director mentioned earlier, we do report these monthly to the legislature. As you can see, the majority of the funding or the expenditures that the state has incurred related to COVID have been supported with federal funds, and that's all the federal funding we've talked about up until now. And a majority of those have gone out in the form of grants. Again, grants to communities, grants to small businesses, out as grants. However, the state has incurred expenditures on state funds and in these other categories, such as COVID leave. We talked about the fact that one of the federal acts expanded the amount or the family medical leave and other leave programs for this, for all employers, the state being one. And that was a mandate that coronavirus relief funds were able to cover. There were also other payroll, COVID-related payroll costs, as the director mentioned. A number of agencies have had to focus on COVID mitigation and response in across the board. There are some modest travel expenses related to COVID. There's $137 million in services costs associated to COVID, about $40 million in laboratory supplies, and $38 million in other supplies, and then a modest amount for capital outlay and equipment.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, this is going back a ways, but I'm looking at the blue sheet, and about halfway down first page, eighth line below the non-state agency subtotal. It says fisheries stimulus through DCCED, anticipate $50K to ADFG for assistance, that's $50 million. And then if you go to the next page, the third line under coronavirus response relief, supplemental appropriation, CRSA Act, it has COVID-19 fisheries relief through Pacific State Marine Fisheries Commission. Expected Alaska request. Well, first of all, those are clarifying, that's two separate amounts, so that's $100 million total. I was just wondering if you would give me, first of all, how much so far you're seeing our fisheries impacted, and then secondly, what would you anticipate these funds to either be used for or requested for?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, they are separate appropriations from the federal government for fisheries relief. One was in the CARES Act, and then there was another one in the Coronavirus Response and Relief Supplemental Appropriations Act. The amount from CRISA is still an estimate. I don't know exactly how much will come to Alaska fisheries, but we expect about the same amount that we received under CARES Act of $50 million. And we should clarify that while we anticipated the funding to go through Commerce, it did not. It is being awarded directly by the Pacific State's Marine Fisheries Commission, and applicants have to apply with that commission. And the Department of Fish and Game has a guidance letter to fisheries participants on how to do that. And the applications just came online today, right? Today's the 1st, March 1st. So now Alaskan fisheries people can apply. Does that answer your questions?
Please proceed.
Okay. Also, in our monthly report to the legislature, we have reported COVID-related revenue loss estimates. So at a total level, petroleum and other revenue, Department of Revenue has estimated FY20, we lost about 500 million, and then FY 22 closer to 600, and FY 2022 576 million. Program by program, that's significantly, it varies significantly. The University of Alaska obviously was hit significantly. Students had to leave, they had to refund tuition. There was a number of situations, so 9.3 million in FY 20, 31.6 in FY 22, and 22.5 in FY, I mean, I said that wrong. The Alaska Marine Highway was obviously hit significantly with revenue losses. Commercial passenger vessel revenue to the state was down, obviously, because we did not have cruise ships. We are, if you look at these estimates, assuming that cruise ships will be back online in FY 22, hopefully. And that's still an estimate. So if the cruise ships do operate in 21, that revenue loss will not be realized. So these are just some major program losses, but there are others, and we do have a full report from state agencies broken out by fiscal year that we can provide to the committee.
We've got a few questions. Representative Josephson, Rasmussen, and Wohl.
Through the chair, to either testifier, this has been enormously helpful. I want to say that. But as to page 16, I'm confused as to you've shown 50 million per fiscal year, but then you think it's 10 times more. Can you explain that?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Josephson. As I mentioned, the big number from Department of Revenue is all state revenue. Includes oil and gas taxes and everything. This lower box is just related to kind of the impacts to state agency program revenue primarily. So that's why.
Representative Rasmussen? Representative Wohl?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when you say petroleum and other, is that mostly petroleum?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, yes. I mean, that was the most significantly hit as a part of COVID, as related to COVID.
And
Representative Mr. Steininger?
Sorry, and to clarify just a little bit on this, both to Representative Josephson's question and Representative Wohl, the petroleum other, that would be unrestricted general fund revenues.
Yeah.
The program revenue would show up in DGF in most agencies' budgets, so this would be, you know, fees charged, for example, you know, fish and game fund would be a lot of, you know, tourists coming in not buying fishing licenses, things of that nature. So not really that unrestricted general fund total, but programmatic, you know, fees and usage related charges in agencies. That's the primary difference.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm just trying to understand the petroleum loss estimate in that production, you know, roughly the same. I know the pipeline had to throttle down temporarily for about a month of 100,000 barrels, but, you know, and there was an oil drop and a supply glut. But it seems by 20, you know, it looks by your chart that that's pretty constant. But how is that all COVID related? Because some of the prices of oil, some of the oil price drop happened before COVID. And I know there was a big drop, but then it bounced back up. In fact, right now we're in the 60s. So how is the three-year $500 million decline, how do you attribute to COVID? I'm just curious.
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, so the way that we're looking at this and calculating the numbers, because as you're alluding to, there's a lot of other factors that go into, you know, oil price, production, and revenues. The Department of Revenue put together their, you know, their fall revenue forecast that comes out every year in early December. What we've done is compared between that revenue forecast that was done in early December, right before COVID on a global scale started to impact things like oil demand in China, and things that impact our revenues. They put it together, you know, right before those things started to occur and started to kind of be noticeable in price. This is a comparison then to our most recent revenue estimates this last December. So you know, a year's time has passed, and looking at what actual revenues in 20 were versus what we had predicted them to be in December of 2019. So most of the impact to those revenues for us are related to those price declines in 20, you know, price going negative for some metrics on oil. Most of those impacts, while maybe not perfectly tied to the virus specifically, were the result of global market conditions changing. Looking forward into the future, and I think that's where kind of some of the bigger question is, how can we look forward that far? It does get hard because the projection done in December of 2019, projecting revenues in fiscal year 22, when we're trying to project this volatile of revenue out that far, it does get a little more art than science. But that's a comparison that we have. We kind of are rooted in that last projection in a pre-COVID world and comparing to that. As we get further from the event, that divergence will start to happen and it will no longer be as tieable to COVID. But given that we're still, the world is still experiencing COVID in a very real way, a lot of the impacts to price and demand for oil still kind of are related to that event. Whether or not the full $576 million represented here is entirely attributable to COVID is an academic question, but it's the data that we have.
Follow up.
Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, because FY22, the cruise ship business is expected to bounce back, so they'll definitely be buying some oil. There will be some return to a pre-COVID world in that column. So hopefully in oil, and I know the 10-year forecast is pretty flat, and that probably was not looking at just the 1 year of COVID. You mentioned University of Alaska returning student tuition. I guess that would be in FY20, because in 21 they signed up and they're in school. So FY20 they had a tuition reimbursement from the March to May portion, but wasn't that covered in the money that the students received? And if that was the case in FY20, 21, 22 wouldn't have a tuition reimbursement section. But yet the loss goes up in 21 and stays pretty high in 22.
Through the chair, Representative Wool, just to answer the one question real quick before I forget it. The funding to students did not cover the university's loss of tuition. The funding went to students for their costs to travel back home, to whatever their costs were, the costs incurred by the students. So. I think on the slide for the university received about $7.9 million, $3.9 of it went to the students for their costs, and yet the university still had to reimburse the students if they didn't, complete. And so that was an also a lost revenue to them. So it was not offset by that. As far as the cost estimates from the university, I do have details, cancellations in housing. They had to significantly restrict their occupancy for their auxiliary services, housing and dining and all of that. And so they've lost revenue, and they project to continue to have lost revenue associated with those capacity issues and other COVID compliance requirements that they don't know when that's going to end. So that's part of the lag.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Following up on the previous question through the chair for Ms. Harbor. The page 9, the CERSA Act, $17.4 million, which was designed to offset enrollment and housing losses. Can we roughly assume that that would help ameliorate the 31.6 that's reflected in the current fiscal year?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the university can use the money they received directly that they did not have to pass through to students to cover their costs. They had COVID-related costs, and they had lost revenue. So it's kind of both. It's the 31.6 they lost in revenue and any costs they've incurred for the technology they've had to do, you know, for the, well, for their costs, their COVID-related costs to become, you know, to make their dorms compliant and all those things. So it's both.
Follow up?
But it sounds like, not that the university would ever give me anything less than credible information, but it sounds like it may testify that along with the, I think, severe cuts that have come through the compact, that they were, you know, that they had other losses that just weren't satisfied, that would be credible.
I don't know if I understood the question.
That they had other losses that simply weren't covered by all of this federal generosity.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that is correct.
Thank you.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess one question that I have when we're discussing government agencies, if you will, that have been impacted and not made whole, it would be interesting if the state had some information on the number of small businesses that have been impacted and, you know, Alaskans who have not been able to work, because I don't think that Alaskans have been made whole either. So when we're considering all of those things, I don't know if you already have that information available, but it is definitely helpful.
Just one comment on that, through the chair, Representative Rasmussen. That is definitely the case, and this is, you know, I don't want to get too out of my depths as, you know, being not professionally an economist, but when you look at that time period of during last year, the loss to the state's GDP compared to the amount of money that came in through all these relief packages, you know, it's easy to see the $6.3 billion and think, well, that's a ton of money that came into the state. You know, that must have solved the problem. But even after all that money came in, there is still a very significant loss to the overall economy in the state in the, you know, billions and billions of dollars range. And that loss was borne by small businesses and individuals and, you know, even large businesses in the state. You know, it was really borne by everybody in the state. And so, you know, well, yes, this portion of our presentation and most of our presentation is focusing on state finances, because that's really what OMB, you know, does. That's what we're thinking about every day. But we can't lose sight of the fact that on a scale, not just every state agency, you know, the relief has not satisfied the loss. You know, that holds true outside of the state system.
Yeah. Any further questions? Okay, well, with that, this is presentation number one out of two presentations today. We do have the presentation from admin, and I guess a question to the committee. We are at the end of our time, and administration is all booked up for the rest of this week, so we can either go another 30 or 45 minutes to finish off that presentation, or we can try to schedule something with them next week. What is the will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be willing to go another 30, 40 minutes, but can we have a 5-minute break? Is that possible?
Yeah, let's see what else folks are thinking. Yeah, we'll take a brief at ease. Okay. House Finance is back on record. And let's see here. We've got Department of Administration online. We should have Commissioner Chewbacca from the Department of Administration. And then in the room here, I assume switching the slides here, Administrative Services Director for the Department, Leslie Isaacs. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Leslie Isaacs. And then online, we've got Dan DiPartolo, Administrative Services Director for the Department of Labor, Lacey Sanders, ASD for Education, Dom Pannon, ASD for Transportation, Michaela Fowler, ASD for Commerce, and then Mr. Isaacs and Commissioner. So with that, I guess, Commissioner, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you for having me today. For the record, this is Kelly Chewbacca, Commissioner of the Department of Administration.
Yes. Looks like your video might be off, Commissioner. If you could switch that to on. Oh, perfect. Thank you. And let's see here. I think the volume. Could you turn up volume a little bit? Great. Okay. I think we can. We're good. Thank you. Go ahead and proceed. Thanks.
Good afternoon, Chair Foster, and Co-Chair Merrick, and representatives. For the record, my name is Tsan Gai. Ooh, that's loud. My name is Tsan Gai. I come from the Kuskadi Eagle Frog Beaver Clan. In English, it would be Leslie Isaacs, the Administrative Services Director for the Department of Administration. And I come to you today from my village of Kloak, down on Prince of Wales Island. And I will be as brief as I can today because this is my first time testifying to the House. So I appreciate sincerely the honor and privilege of being here testifying today. With that, we'll move right into slide number 2. In April of 2020, the governor came to DOA and asked us to prepare a plan to deal with the outbreak of the pandemic. DOA's response was to create the pandemic preparedness plan. As we affectionately call it in DOA, it's the PPP plan. I think one of the representatives asked if I could squeeze in another P, but not quite sure how we would get to that, except for phases 1, phase 2, and phase 3. But we also have what we call the quality assurance phase, which is at the bottom of the slide, but not to be mistaken that it is what we feel is the most important phase of the pandemic preparedness plan. The QA phase, as we call it, allowed us to set up assurances that your investment, the state of Alaska's investment in the pandemic preparedness plan, would be well spent and well utilized, well utilization of the funds. When the governor came to us in April, he asked us to make sure that we could ensure worker safety and maintain continuity of government services and operations. We were allocated less than 1% of the amount of money that OMB, my actual bosses in the governor's office, shared with you in their presentation. We actually received less than 1% of those funds for the amount of $58,180,000, as you can see there on the top left of the slide. Phases 1, 2, and 3 expenditures account for $52,842,529 at the time we put this slide together for this presentation. That also includes the amount that we expect to spend in FY21 as well. And so that puts us squarely under budget by $5.3 million. We've let the Department of Health and Social Services, as well as the governor's office through OMB, know that we have that, those funds still unallocated and unspent if they need to redeploy those for other purposes that they see fit. The pandemic preparedness plan phase one evaluated the core services that existed across the state. We looked at what services could be digitized and what processes could be digitized. Phase two started to take a look at the telework infrastructure and what we have called Aspire Alaska, which is our performance management system and our learning management system for supervisors that are spread throughout the state. Phase three is a little more convoluted, and when you look at the breakdown of the expenditures, it gets to be pretty interesting because it resides primarily in the Office of Information Technology. There were a lot of things that needed to be done in order to enable teleworking. And just as a side note, those things that were done before I was hired in August allow me to be a permanent ASD teleworker from my village down in Kluwak. So one of the senators in my presentation asked me if I go home for the summer, and I said, no, sir, I live there year-round. So not only do I raise my 8 children and my 16 grandchildren there, but they all attend Kluwak School District, which, as we all know, helps with school funding, helps with economic development in the villages, and I'm pretty doggone proud to say that I'm a permanent teleworker by the grace of this administration and DOA's commissioner. Also in the phase three is the service management system, the Alaska Now, which has and will automate over 160 manual processes that exist across the state. Some of those include the automation of onboarding, recruitment, and timesheets. And I'm not sure if you want to, maybe just to let you know I'm done with that slide, or?
Are there any questions? Please continue.
Thank you. And slide three just points out the six phases of Alaska's PPP plan as DOA has developed it. We'll get into a little more of the detail of phases one, two, and three. I think the important thing to note here is that because we only had December 30 of 2020 as the finish line for the initial use of the CRF funds, that phases four, five, and six had to be taken off of the plan to be completed. If we were given more CRF funds to continue through FY21, we would be able to put phases four, five, and six into place. For brevity's sake, I will not read you the rules that come with the CRF funds. I think OMB covered that rather well in their presentation. Suffice it to say that DOA has the Division of Finance within our team work, and we run all of the CARES Act funded requests through DOF to make sure that we adhere to the Coronavirus Relief Fund rules as they apply, because they, as noted earlier, they changed and changed quite often in the beginning. I apologize, I think the first version of our slide deck didn't have all of the states that we had found out use CARES Act funding to improve teleworking capabilities, but the slide that's on the screen shows the other states within the lower 48 of states that have used CRF funds to do exactly this, or I'm sorry, I shouldn't say exactly, but to do similar things like what we've done here for improving teleworking and keeping workers safe. In case you're not sure, Missouri and Oklahoma are the two that we found out were added to the slide deck. We've mentioned previously that we had set up quality assurance first as a priority to ensure that all of our PPP projects were completed and that the legislators received value for their investment. I always have a hard time with legislator and legislature. One of our main contractors was Wasserman and Associates, a Juneau-based firm, to make sure that all of the work being done was beneficial and complete for the state of Alaska. It's also important to note that DOA has set up a governance team to ensure project success and effective, realistic management, project management and execution. This has not been done, to my understanding, in the past. So this is a new way for DOA to open up to the other departments to make sure they're on board with how we are proceeding with these various projects that we've accomplished through the PPP. Phase one is complete. And in phase one, we assessed and analyzed what the state of Alaska is doing and how we can modify those tasks, services, and business processes so that they can best be performed from home offices in a telecommuting environment. It's interesting to note that one of my staff has told me that she meets more often with me via Teams meetings than she did with my predecessors. I'm not quite sure how to take that because there was quite a lengthy vacancy in my position within DOA. So I'm hoping that we meet more often than my immediate predecessor. Phase one also identified and prioritized a list of 128 tasks, services, and or business processes that could be modified for improved function during the COVID pandemic. These initiatives are the substance of the PPP phases 4, 5, and 6. Slide 8 shares 23 of the 128 projects identified in phase one. Slide 9 delves into phase two, which we have affectionately called the Pathway Project. The Pathway Project has allowed us to launch Aspire Alaska, which is the automation training and performance management. It offers over 2,000 online courses, training courses to our employees, facilitating remote learning and professional development, enabling SOA to manage employee development, create career path progressions, and to develop mastery paths. And as you can see, there's quite a lengthy list of objectives on the right-hand side of the slide as well. In essence, this has allowed people like myself to telework from the villages where we have a reliable high-speed internet connection. It's funny because one of my coworkers reported that even though he has an office in the building and he goes to it, that he meets via Teams messaging more often than he does face-to-face during the pandemic to get our jobs done. Phase three, this slide breaks down more of the enabling technology, the connectivity, collaboration, security, productivity, and automation that we have achieved and we will continue to work on. It's interesting to note that one of the questions from the representative earlier was how much of your operating budget has been displaced by COVID or CRF funds. The Department of Administration is proud to say that we, by direction of our commissioner, have not replaced any of our operating expenditures, with one caveat that we hired some short-term non-perm help when we received those 4,300 laptops that were all purchased at the same time. We took advantage of our procurement consolidation and we bundled that purchase and all of a sudden 4,300 laptops show up. We needed some help in preparing those for deployment to state of Alaska workers so they could telework safely. Now my favorite slide, because we talk about the fiscal responsibility that DOA has shown through phases 1, 2, and 3 of the PPP plan. Phase one, we had a total allocation of $780,000. We came in slightly under budget with a remaining balance of $3,758. In phase two, we received from the governor permission to and an allocation of $11.4 million. We currently have a remaining balance of $3.69 million. And phase three, because it is the has the broadest reach in terms of the enabling technology, we plan on utilizing the full allocation of $41.4 million. And according to our division of OIT director, if you gave him more money, he could use it. We had a 1 hour presentation that I just did in 15 for you, so.
Are there any questions? Representative Edgman?
Yes, would that have been an hour if you were presenting? So, as the department's director of division of admin, you work full time from your home village, is that correct?
Yes, sir. I'm sorry, through the chair, Representative Edgman, yes, sir.
Yeah, that's very impressive. If I might, Madam Chair, just to put this in the full context, I feel like I'm entering into this discussion midstream. The whole notion of doing this was brought on by the pandemic, and now it has grown into maybe a model that other state agencies can use. Am I getting that chronology correct?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, yes, sir. If you're going to look for a silver lining in the cloud called the pandemic, teleworking and being able to hire qualified people to fill state of Alaska positions that live in our rural villages is the silver lining to the pandemic. Because without the pandemic, it would not have made a situation like mine possible. Yes, sir.
So, we get to herd immunity or whatever it might be called later on, would you continue to work from your village as admin services director?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, at this point I'm told that I'm going to be a permanent teleworker. And as we all know, we have an election every few years, and when leadership changes, that may change. But the answer to your question as it is today is yes. I will continue to serve the people of Alaska from my village in Kowal.
A last question, if I might. I'm trying to get a sense of if and when this gets to phase three and full implementation, how significant of cost savings could be engendered by full implementation of this across the span of 14, 15, however many state agencies that are out there? I mean, maybe this is a question for the commissioner, but how, I'm trying to get some kind of a magnitude of order of how significant this could be ultimately.
Certainly, through the chair, Representative Edgman, I believe that we at DOA are working with OMB to do a space study analysis of leased space across the state. And we would also be working with other departments to determine how many of their staff can be permanent teleworkers and what those savings may implicate for the state. I probably should back up and say that within DOA that our commissioner supports the teleworking position, and the caveat is that your supervisor has to approve that your position is teleworking capable. So there are some positions within DOA that do not fit the telework model simply because you have to handle paper. But there's a lot of things through this enabling technology that allows you to do your job all digitized without printing out paper and handling paper.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have Representative Ortiz and then LeBron.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Isaacs, for your presentation. And I'm certainly, glad to hear that person from the community of Kowak, Isaac's name is, of course, well-known in that area, that you can work at home and take care of your kids and those kinds of things. That's a good thing. However, my question is, I actually have a couple of questions. When we talk about teleworking and the process of that being developed further and further, is there a certain point where there's an evaluation of the impact on overall quality and delivery of services that's going to take place? In other words, is there going to be some sort of evaluation as to, while it's a good thing that you get to work at home, is the net effect of many people working home going to bring overall positive benefits to the state of Alaska in the delivery of the services?
I'll answer that through the chair. Put myself on the record again. This is Kelly Shabaka, the commissioner of the Department of Administration. We've already analyzed that. We did a survey in 2020 to see how telework was affecting our departments as we were going through COVID, and we found that across the board, the responses from our employees, our supervisors, and our executive management was that we were achieving more mission and more results with telework. However, some of the concerns expressed were that with long-term telework, as it was going on, because remember in the beginning we thought this would only be a couple months, we were losing some of those things that are important to our workforce, like trust, collaboration, and values that come with culture. And that's just part of what gets sacrificed when you don't see people in person. And so as we have the ability to move back into office spaces, we will need to assess how often we bring teleworkers in so that we can reclaim some of those in-person values that are really important to developing a workforce. This is something that I have experienced doing back in Washington, D.C., creating staggered work schedules or in-person meetings where you come in for what we call a red team or a touchdown room where you work on projects in person for a specific purpose, but you still get all the maximum benefits of telework. We do intend to continue using surveys and polls to measure what's happening in the workforce, and that's part of what that continued effort of the pathway program that Leslie Isaacs talked about. When we're doing phase two implementation throughout 2021, we're continuing to measure our workforce through our performance plan. We had to change the way we do our performance planning and metrics, because before we measured employees more on things like how many hours they worked or when they were in the office, and less on things like what their outcomes were. And we needed to change that to match a telework workforce, because supervisors were expressing to us that they didn't really know what their employees were doing, and that put them in a really tenuous spot. But now, with 7,000 employees having gone through our pathway program last year, we have a much better idea of exactly what everybody's doing from their telework location. And so we can measure that directly every day, every week, and that throughout the performance year cycle. So that's what our pathway plan gave us the tools to do.
Follow up. And appreciate that answer, Commissioner, very much. Kind of like, though, on a related note, to what level, how much of telework that is currently being done for the state of Alaska is being done by people who now live outside the state, and so therefore resources, money, salaries, etc., get circulated in those areas rather than within the state of Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative, we have about 55 to 60 people on the last spreadsheet I saw who are working out of state. That's across all of the departments in the state. That's not in the Department of Administration. Those out-of-state telework agreements have to be approved by your commissioner. We are currently going through and almost finished revising an update to our telework policy, where we're going to further limit out-of-state telework agreements because of the change in the nature of COVID. We now have a massive vaccine rollout. We now have a lot fewer cases of COVID, a lot more people who've had it and aren't getting transmission as much. And so we really feel comfortable that we're going to limit it and say things like, we're only going to grant out-of-state telework if you have to go out-of-state to care for someone who's sick, or you have to go out-of-state for your own medical care, and put even more limited restrictions on it. I want to be clear that you not only have to get commissioner approval if you're an exempt employee, but if you're a bargaining unit employee, you have to get your union's approval as well. So the standard for getting an out-of-state telework agreement is going to be very high going forward.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I would just like to add too that one of my duties is to sign off on those telework agreements as they process the way through. And currently they are only being approved for a 3-month period of time at a time. So these are being reviewed every quarter with that criteria that the commissioner shared with you in mind.
Thank you. Representative Lebon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Ortiz asked one of the questions I was going to ask about how many out-of-state employees we have. And philosophically, I don't think we should have any, if at all possible. I mean, I understand that it happens, but I sure hope that what I'm hearing from the commissioner is that you will look very hard at that happening. One of the things that the private sector deals with is something called workman's comp within the office place. If we have how many employees? Did I hear 7,000 employees that are working from home or from some other location? How does that impact workman's comp? If an employee is injured at home, is that a workman's comp event?
Through the chair, I appreciate the question. The answer is it depends on what they were doing, where they were doing it, and when. So there's several factors that come into play. In general, for example, I'm in my work location right now. If I were to get hurt right now, yes, I would be covered by workers' comp. But you would be happy to know that our workers' compensation claims have dropped dramatically since we've had such a high increase in telework. That's positive news for the state.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any further questions?
So just a quick question then of, I think we saw the other day that there's approximately about 20,000 state workers or so. So 7,000 of the 20,000 at this moment are teleworking. Is that correct?
Through the chair, the current number right now is somewhere between probably 5,300 to 6,000. It really fluctuates depending on the need at the time. So I'll use an example from our department. We have the public defender agency, and depending on what the court is doing and depending on their clients' needs, there will be more attorneys who come in the office to meet with clients, or more of them will go home. It also depends on what's happening in the office health-wise. We just had a health scare in one of our offices. They were all in the office last week. None of them are in the office this week. So that's how it works in every office and in every department. On the high side through COVID, we've had about 6,000 employees in teleworking. And the 7,000 number is how many of our PCNs went through the pathway project so that they went through a new performance planning development system. That's not how many people we've had teleworking. They're just the ones who have now a revised performance plan system that's teleworkable, if you will. But the most that we've had teleworking at a time is around 6,000.
And I think it's pretty apparent to say that in comparison to the other states that we saw on a previous slide, Alaska is definitely on the vanguard in terms of this effort nationwide. Is that correct?
So through the chair, when we started this process and we led with it when the governor came with us, we asked around the same question we asked as we were preparing these slides. There was only one other state that had started to use money for telework capability. I think one of the things we also identified is most of the other states had already started teleworking. When we started at the beginning of COVID, we had less than 1% of our employees teleworking at all. We didn't have a telework infrastructure. We didn't have heightened VPN capacity for cybersecurity on our network. We hadn't deployed extensive amount of state laptops. We had no infrastructure in place. I don't want to make you laugh, but we didn't even have DocuSign. And so all of our documents had to be signed in person. How do you make a government work when all of your employees are working out of their homes and we can't sign documents? So we had to set up an infrastructure that none of the other 49 states had to set up from scratch. And we had to do it on a really expedited timeframe because the original guidance said you must be done by December 30th. And setting up a lot of IT deployments on a timeline like that, doing it under budget, doing it without error, you know, all IT deployments have issues and bugs and stuff. I think of this as a government miracle, and all credit goes to the government employees who work in DOA because they really worked day and night and weekends to make sure that all this got done on time, under budget, by the coronavirus guidelines that were in place. So yes, we were leading the nation. A lot of people have looked at us since and kind of said, hey, where did Alaska come from in this, that we were able to pull off such an extraordinary feat in changing our business practices? But then I think the other states looked at us and said, wait, we can do this too, because it does ensure our worker safety. Fortunately, we didn't lose a single day of operating the state government because of what the DOA employees were able to do. Nor did we hear about government buildings being a place of a super spreader event for COVID because we had so many people teleworking. And those are two big wins that our DOA staff were able to add to the coronavirus response.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, I guess through the commissioner, just to clarify, the $53 million spent was entirely federal money? Is that right?
Through the chair, yes, that's correct. Those are all coronavirus funds.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions?
Sure.
Representative Ortiz?
Yes, I think my question could go for probably Mr. Isaacs first. You go to slide 8, and you talk about 23 of 128 projects identified in phase 1. And going to the category of DMV, can you describe in more detail what the project actually entailed when you talk about car titling? I mean, I know what car titling is, but in relationship to the project, what was the project in relationship to car titling and driver's license knowledge test, that kind of thing? DMV stuff is what I'm talking about.
Certainly. Thank you, through the chair, Representative Ortiz. If I could, I would like to defer to the commissioner. This was done prior to my hire date.
Okay.
And so a lot of these projects were undertaken. I would like to share with the committee, though, that I just recently bought my wife a new car, and the dealership sent the application. I received a call from the Palmer office, gave them my credit card over the phone. And 2 days later, my title's in the mail. I haven't received that, but I did receive my plates in the mail 2 days later. And so I could speak very directly to the process as it's in place now, but I have no knowledge of how we got there. I could just tell you that it works really, really well.
Commissioner?
Through the chair, each of these projects, Representative, are ones that we currently do in person or through the mail, and we could turn them into digital processes. So these would be the top 23 that we identified as low-hanging fruit, easy return on investment. Over at the DMV, these are ones that we could turn into digital interfaces so people would not have to come in anymore or do them in person. So that's what those are referring to.
Follow up?
Thank you, and I can certainly appreciate that. However, I've heard of some concerns from some of my constituents in relationship to, while people now can, quote, do things digitally, some people particularly, well, I shouldn't say particularly, but for example, in the elder community, may not have the wherewithal, the knowledge, the access to digital processes, those kinds of things. and they've been, frankly, very frustrated by the change. So have you heard similar things?
Through the chair, yes, absolutely, which means they could still come into DMVs and do them in person. This is just creating an alternative access point, whereas right now, for those three services, nobody has the option of doing them digitally. Everyone still has to come into the DMV. And so we want to just create options for people so that you have some other alternatives. Right now, these are creating lines, backlogs, delays at DMVs, and they don't need to. We could clear out a lot of traffic at DMVs and just have an online option available. Another thing that I'll share, I think this is important to know, I've been working with some of our stakeholders and partners to see when are we going to get internet across the state. And what I'm hearing from partners is that within 2 years from today, we should have internet for everybody, no matter where you are. That's something I'm considering when I'm pushing digital initiatives for the state. I agree with you that it's unfair to say, that's really great that all the people who live in internet places can do all these things digitally. So if we're going to digitize 128 constituent services, essentially turn our state government digital, that only benefits people who live in places with internet. That's not fair. Well, if it's going to take us about a year to two to turn all these things digital, that syncs up with when everybody will have digital access. That's perfect timing. That's part of my thinking.
And then final follow-up on this topic. Certainly can appreciate that and truly do appreciate those efficiencies being found, et cetera. However, again, it's one thing to say that they can still come in and do things the way that they've done them in the past if you continue to have a DMV office that's open versus I see a list of about 6 or 7 DMV offices that are scheduled to be closed. And again, there's some real concern there about how people who don't have access to digitalization options, how can they get these things done? I mean, there's real concerns about that particular issue.
Agreed. Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, our proposal is to transition those DMVs to public-private partnerships. So like how the Postal Service has FedEx partnerships, we would transition them to private partnerships so that there are DMV services available in those communities and not just back out DMVs completely. So the idea would be we get rid of the cost to the state, but we still are able to provide services to the community members who need them. And then people who don't want to use the private partnership, they're able to either drive up the road to the state DMV or access us through online or through the mail. That's the idea that we're proposing.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, I wasn't going to involve myself in this discussion, but just, Commissioner, there's concern among Alaskans about shifting to a public-private partnership. Alaskans are aware that the DMV, some are, is a moneymaker for the state, and sure, it's a topic of humor. DMVs across the country are, but I think on the whole, the public is satisfied with the product they're getting and the services they're getting. And so I share Representative Ortiz's concerns. It's more of a comment than a question.
So if I could respond through the chair, I understand the concerns, which is why we're simply offering them to you all as policymakers, as proposals. I think we have a significant challenge ahead of us with a $2 billion plus budget. We, as commissioners, were all given a task to say, can you please come up with some ideas of how to bridge that gap? We at the department are trying to come up with ideas that maximize some options without really digging into cutting services that Alaskans need. This was just an idea that's before you. I would ask that you consider them as 6 different ideas because the situation in each different location is a little bit unique, and therefore your consideration as policymakers. And I understand we all are struggling with these challenges of how to bridge this gap. One side is the revenue part of the bridge. The other side is the cost of government part of the bridge. And this is one solution we have. The other one are some of the other ideas that you see before you. For example, what Leslie just presented to you is, you know, we've got the idea of digitizing these other 128 initiatives. It costs $25 million to do that, but once we do, it'll save us $89 million a year. So there's different things that we can do in the department to help get us there. They're all just ideas before you.
Any further questions? Mr. Isaacs?
Madam Chair, thank you. I'd just like to share my personal experience, and I think Representative Ortiz has been out to my village, but when I turned 16 and received my driver's license, and that's a few years ago now, I went to the local DMV office in Craig, and it's located in the police station, and it is a public-private partnership with the city of Craig. So this model that we are proposing is not new to State of Alaska DMV, but rather it's been around, tried and true, for a lot of years. So again, this was back in the 80s. So thank you, ma'am.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Commissioner, and thank you, Mr. Isaacs. Our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, March 2nd at 9 a.m. At that meeting, we will continue our presentation on the FY22 budget. We will start with the Office of Management and Budget and from the Division of Legislative Finance. With that, at 4:18, we are adjourned.